Welcome to High Notes. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. We are coming to you today from Christchurch Episcopal in the West End of Aspen, and this is being broadcast on Aspen Public Radio, the voice of classical music in Aspen, and will also be available on a podcast. And this is new this summer, so pretty much any platform where you like to go and find podcasts, you will find this there. But you can also go to our website, www.aspenmusicfestival.com, and find the podcasts of all the High Notes as they come throughout the season. So, as very often happens with these talks, we are forcing some of our participants to rehearse and work right up until noon, and then whisking them in a car as fast as we can to come. So today we are going to be joined later by Sarah Chang and Patrick Summers. In fact, I see them approaching up the steps of the church right now. But already I have with us composer Stephen Hartke. So we're just going to begin right away, and then Maestro Summers is coming up the aisle, and Sarah Chang will be... How are you? And... Right. So I'm now going to sit, so I won't be able to see you as well anymore. Our program today is centered on the Friday evening concert, so July 14, 6 p.m. in the Benedict Music Tent, Aspen Chamber Symphony. And the program includes a work by composer Stephen Hartke, who's with us, then two works for violin and orchestra with Sarah Chang, and then a gorgeous orchestra-only segment led by Patrick Summers. Stephen Hartke is now one of the leaders of our composition program in Aspen, and was for many years at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music, and has now moved to Oberlin College Conservatory recently. He's one of the most celebrated and honored composers in America, and I will say that our summer program in composition is now one of the two most selective programs we have in the entire Aspen Music Festival and School. We had a record number of composers apply this year for just 10 positions in the program. Those young composers come for 8 weeks, and they work for 4 weeks with Stephen, for 4 weeks with Chris Theophanides, and also every week with a really remarkable list of guest composers who are visiting. So our purpose is not to talk about the composition program per se, but I wanted you to know that Stephen is playing a really essential role in all that we do with new music in Aspen. So thus, it's a pleasure this week to be programming a work of his. The piece is called Pacific Rim. It's for a chamber-sized orchestra, and in fact was commissioned originally by three of the most important chamber orchestras in America, the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and Hudson Valley, and a commission from the National Endowment for the Arts. So if Stephen doesn't mind, and if you don't mind, I'm going to just pause for a little commercial for the National Endowment, which has been threatened recently. But if not for them, we would not have this really wonderful work. I don't know if you want to say anything about the NEA.
Just to concur. But also I should say just that actually it's been a long time since they've been able to give commissions of this sort. And they did a great service to the country for a long time. But I think it's been 20 years since there's been grants to individual artists.
So the piece is called Pacific Rim, and Stephen, you were living in Los Angeles at the time of its composition. And in what way does it reflect, absorb, present ideas about the Pacific Rim?
Well, okay, quite overtly, I'm not ashamed to say. The initial commission request for the piece came from the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, where I had just started as the composer in residence. And this was written for the 20th anniversary of the orchestra. And since they're coming up on their 50th anniversary the following season, after this one, that was a long time ago. But this piece has done well for me, and it's one of the only orchestra pieces I've had that's been played on four continents, so I'm happy about that. So in being asked to write a piece that was to open that season and to celebrate, I decided that I wanted to do something that was about the screaming cultural diversity of Los Angeles. And so the piece falls into two parts. There really is an Asian part, Asian influence part, and then there is a Latin influence part. So as it's sort of the mixing of cultures, the Western culture, the American culture that I was born into is represented by the fact that this is a classical orchestra that is evoking aspects of music that don't necessarily belong to that tradition, but which I like to put in there. As I told the orchestra this morning in the rehearsal, no actual Asian music was harmed in the creation of this piece. I draw from many, many elements in a way which I describe as ethnomusicological fiction, and by which I mean that I imagine myself to be the master of a non-Western musical tradition, a non-existent one, because these various orchestral traditions in different cultures and all cultures have, you know, are very finely honed over time, either through notation, as in the case of the West and some others, or through oral tradition. And if you take, for example, Japanese gagaku music, you have this orchestra of very diverse instruments that are really essentially playing the same melody, but each color is playing in its own fashion. And so I was drawing upon that in my piece. You will hear high floating woodwind chords that are rather like a mouth organ that is used in the Japanese gagaku orchestra. There's a melody that spins through that uses a mode of scale that sounds a bit Asian, but it really isn't. It's my own thing that I work through. The melody is presented mostly in the oboes, and then as the rules that I know as the master of my non-existent musical world are things like certain details in the melody are picked up by certain kinds of colors. A fall of in the melody might lead to the violins tapping on their strings with the stick of the bow. The violas play only the little tiny short rhythms. There are these various details that are highlighted in what I call a lapidary fashion. Little bits in the melody are picked up, and they're little gemstones that are inserted in there to give it a special kind of sparkle. And so this is a processional. It's quite lively and celebratory, and then it suddenly turns a corner, and you're left with a passage of slow, quiet string chords that are rising, which I personally imagine is flying over the Pacific. That's the way you're just gliding over the ocean, and you see that flat, unruffled surface for the most part. And then you arrive on the other side, and where there is a fugue. So it's a prelude and fugue. And the fugue is built on a tune, a theme that is made up of only two pitches, played on tuned cowbells, an evocation of the cowbells of Latin American music. And also a reminder, when we talk about the Pacific Rim, we are all sort of mostly talking about the Northern Pacific, about Asia and America. We forget, of course, that there's a whole Latin American coastline that is also part of that world. So the second part, as I said, is a fugue that's based on this theme, and it's quite strict. I had just finished teaching a counterpoint class at USC that season, semester, so I guess it was in my blood, and I had to do it to get rid of it. And then it ends on a, I think, quite cheerful note.
So, if I may editorialize, it's an exceptionally attractive piece, and I was going to ask you about fugue, because a funny thing happened with fugue, as also happened with counterpoint in general, which is that there were centuries of practice of this form. And then a really brilliant theorist came along and decided to create a textbook on fugue, and I'm thinking of Gedalge, I don't know if you've ever encountered that book, explaining what the principles were which in fact govern fugues from Bach to Handel to Mozart to Beethoven. So I was going to ask, how strict is your fugue in those terms?
Well, considering it's only two pitches, gosh, it's kind of hard to say. but it is strict. There are three entries, and there are counter subjects, and there are middle entries, which is the return of the main theme, and there are stretti. There's one particular stretto that you'll notice that's between horns that come in unison, and they gradually flatten the pitch, so it sounds like an ambulance.
Yeah,
the piece is urban, you know.
I was going to ask about the horns, because I should warn the audience that the horns are not making mistakes. They're supposed to they're supposed to get quite out of tune. How do they do that?
They do. It's very simple. If you slide your hand into the bell slowly, it gradually flattens the pitch. You can flatten it quite a lot.
Okay, great. Well, the fugue was sometimes seen as the ultimate in mastery of compositional form, and perhaps conventionally a little dry for that reason. But as Bach shows us over and over again, the fugue can be totally fun as well, and this is an extremely fun fugue. Yeah. Great. And before we move along, Patrick, I don't know if you wanted to comment on Stephen's piece or preparing it with the orchestra.
Oh, it's been very challenging to prepare with the orchestra because it's not conventionally what they normally play, you know. But the challenges that are within it are so brilliant for the students that, you know, the difference between yesterday and today was remarkable. You know, with extremely talented musicians as one has in Aspen, the distance from A to B is very fast. So that was thrilling this morning. And we played it for Stephen the first time this morning.
Okay. So I was going to ask Stephen, do you go to first rehearsals or do you stay away?
Well, usually you're asked to stay away.
I didn't want him there yesterday, frankly. Yeah. So.
But I will say I voluntarily did not go yesterday because I thought, well, no one said anything, but, you know, I know.
But it's so helpful to have a composer present for the rehearsal once you're beyond the initial semantics of a rehearsal. I mean, we've just welcomed Sarah Chang, of course, who's just come down the aisle, as they say. Sarah and I have just been rehearsing the Ravel Cigan just, you know, 10 minutes ago.
Sorry, I was late.
And
how are you on time?
Yeah, I just
how
got here before you.
That was amazing.
But how I wish I'd had Maurice Ravel in the room this morning to say, what the hell were you thinking about some of this? Pardon my English in church. But, you know, because it's such a crazy, crazy piece, that Cigan. So it was great to have Stephen at the rehearsal this morning.
Good. Well, we'll turn to Ravel in just one moment. But I myself insist on going to first rehearsals, and then what happens over and over again is I just think, oh my gosh, it's a horrible piece. It sounds terrible. It's unplayable. And if I'd only stayed away, I wouldn't have had that experience. But as Patrick says, so Patrick Summers, our maestro this week. Patrick is music director of the Houston Grand Opera and an all-around great guy. And he's with us with a variety of projects, but this Friday's concert among them. And so the program goes on to Cigan, which is a 20th century work by Ravel, I think 1924, and began as a violin piano piece, but sort of a weird thing was going on with that violin piano piece. Sarah, have you ever played it with the extra stuff on the piano? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, yeah. Ravel wrote it with a sort of extra thing that was, I would say, like a cimbalom from Hungarian music, sort of. But it provided some percussive other effects to the piano. No one had one, so it almost never is played with that. It can be played with just violin and piano. But almost immediately, Ravel made a dazzling orchestration of it himself. And he was one of the greatest writers for orchestra. I don't like saying orchestrator because that sounds different. But as a composer, he was one of those brilliant users of orchestra. As a sideline, by the way, if you think of composers in that way, you immediately think of Berlioz. And we have some very important and striking works of Berlioz this summer. And then Richard Strauss, and we always have a lot of Strauss. But Ravel, we have an especially large number of his works for orchestra this summer. And so I thought I'd start by asking both Patrick and Sarah about the difference between playing this piece with piano or playing it in the orchestration.
Well, being a pianist myself, I can I can say that it's a work that he clearly conceived for orchestra, because it puts your thumbs in all the wrong places on the piano. It's not just that it's difficult to play on the piano, it's that it's not conceived for the instrument. So from my standpoint, he was conceiving of this always as an orchestral work for violin. Because it can certainly be played on the piano and is, but it really feels like you're playing a piano reduction of an orchestration, you know, as we do in opera all the time. You know, Wagner never feels right on the piano because it isn't conceived for the piano, you know, and I feel that way about Sagan, but Sarah may feel differently. Have you done it with piano a lot?
I have, but here's the thing. We just met like 3 hours ago. For the first time, and we went through our conductor's rehearsal with Maestro playing on the piano, and this is such a luxury that you almost never ever get. You know, conductors, usually when you have our first meeting, you know, we go over tempi and then just the general sort of slower here, faster here, tempo here, that's it. But like we literally went through every note and he was on the piano reading from the score, which is like amazing. So I'm always really, really grateful when maestros, you know, take that extra step and really make it a chamber music experience. You know, it always makes it a lot more fun. So the Sagan is crazy. It's a monster of a piece. You know, there's just way too much going on in the violin, and not just the violin, but also the orchestra. It is incredibly tricky for the winds and the brass, and if you listen to the piece, it is essentially a virtuosic piece for every single musician in the orchestra. And it's very tricky to put together ensemble-wise, and it's also a jewel of a piece, though, you know, when you actually do get through a few rehearsals and you all click together and you start breathing as one and moving as one. It is an absolute jewel of a piece and just so much fun to play and such a firecracker of a showpiece. So it'll be fun. It's going to be a fun show.
So Tsigan means gypsy. And the piece, I think, has the same relationship, though, to gypsy music as Stephen Harkey's piece has to traditional Japanese music. That is, there are no gypsy melodies present. There is no evocation of any particular gypsy thing except the mood, which is crazy. Also like the Stephen Harkey piece, it's in two sections. And it starts with a very long solo section. And then, to me, just one of the great inspirations is how the other part comes in. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Well, it's so unexpected because the solo violin has gone on for so long, like a gypsy etude of some sort. And it's probably 4 minutes or
a cadenza at the very beginning of the piece.
It starts with a cadenza.
Takes about 9 weeks. It literally does not end. It goes on forever. And it's all very, very intense, too. You know, if you look at the marking, first of all, everything is forte, fortissimo, you know, dramatic, expressive. But there's, like, zero piano. So you're playing, 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 and playing hard the entire time for, like, 9 whole weeks. And then finally, the orchestra comes in. But the way the orchestra comes in is so beautiful. Yeah. And it's not like everybody starts playing. He introduces the harpist first, you know? So you start playing with the harp and the violin, and there's this amazing, amazing little duet going on.
Extraordinary color that it starts. He starts with the harp very, very low, takes the harp very, very high, and adds one or two notes per beat. So it starts with this very calm harp, and then it gets, you know, more and more roiling each time into the gypsy melody, his evocation of the gypsy melody. It's
now the opening being so dramatic. I wonder how you do it, Sarah, because your playing is usually very reserved and undramatic. So how do you approach this? I'm just making a joke because I've not properly introduced Sarah Chang, of course, one of the great violinists in the world today, and also so familiar to us happily in Aspen since you've been with us many years. But thank you for being back. So now, what's your dramatic approach? Do you think of a story? Do you think of gesture? What do you think of?
So I do think of this as what it is. You know, it is an in-your-face, flamboyant showpiece. You know, I don't pretend that it's not that because it is very much a flamboyant showpiece. Having said that, there's an elegance to the Ravel that sometimes you miss in other sort of firecracker, dynamo sort of, you know, showpieces because there's a lot of that sort of give and take nuance going on, as well as a lot of chamber music, like, you know, question and answers going on with the orchestra. And there's so many different layers if you actually look into the piece, that it's not just about fast fingers and big sound and just being as virtuosic as you possibly can, but there are so many hidden layers of intricate chamber music, like melodies together, interwoven together, and just a lot of beauty.
Incredible orchestral colors. I love today, since we rehearsed it right after Stephen's piece, the way the two pieces talk to each other in terms of orchestral color is really fascinating.
So I do always try to, you know, remember in my head, even if you're looking at essentially a black sheet of music, because it's all notes. Yeah. It's all the 16th note, all 32nd notes, and all just technical notes. And to find the beauty and the elegance in the piece within all that, you know, sort of kitchen sink work going on. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, fast fingers and, you know, great sort of like technique is fun, but it can be kind of boring, you know, if there's no music and no soul underneath it. And the Ravel has just soul galore. You know, there's so much musicality and so much nuance and elegance in the piece.
Now, Ravel in his piano music really created his own kind of virtuosity, and his piano music hits the highest levels of virtuosic difficulty in the whole repertoire, but it's his own thing. And I always hear Tsigan as very related to Sarasate. I don't know if you... Yeah. Yes? No?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I completely agree. I think when you think of gypsy works, right, there are... You know, there's the Tsigan, there's also the Sigourney Weisen, you know, which is very, very well known. And then, you know, Rams did a few sort of Hungarian dances that somehow borrow on the whole gypsy theme a tiny bit. But this takes it to a whole other level, where Ravel asks for particular sounds. You know, there are places where he wants Ponticello, which means you're playing as close to the bridge as possible, and he wants this really gritty, almost rough sound. And you're taught as a student, especially here, like, you know, I went to Juilliard and Aspen growing up, and you're always taught, don't make a rough sound, don't make an ugly sound, you know. You spend years and years and years, you know, trying to pull a beautiful sound, and then you look at the music, and he specifically asks for a Ponticello sounds, where he wants that grittiness and that sort of scratchiness where, you know, you almost want to cringe. Exactly, where you want to cringe, but in a way, somehow when you put it together, with all the percussion and all the winds, everybody doing their thing, it actually makes the whole thing make sense, you know? It adds an incredible color.
Now, we're thinking a lot this summer about the concerto, because in planning the season, at a certain point, we weren't planning for this, but at a certain point, we realized we had really a lot of new concertos this summer, as well as a lot of existing concertos, which we always have. And so on July 20th, with the Aspen Institute, we're presenting a seminar. It's a half-day, afternoon-long seminar on the concerto. And in anticipation of that, I wondered, Stephen, if you would talk some about the rhetoric of writing for solo instrument and orchestra and Tsigan as one of the sort of furthest out there examples of that rhetoric.
Well, I when I think about the appeal of the concerto, it's that it's wonderful for the audience to have that focus of that one person who is carrying the torch for the whole musical enterprise in a way. And I think it gives us much more to root for than when you just have a symphony. That's always been the attraction, and also provides this wonderful focus. You hear the ideas in the orchestra more as things that spin off from or that engender, and they suddenly come to a culmination within the soloist itself. But I don't want to go too far into that, because we're going to do that next week. You know, I don't give
Stay
it away.
Stay tuned. That is next Thursday. But Sarah, since you will not be there for that concerto thing, violin concertos, the violinist can be a part of the orchestra, sort of like an ideal member of the orchestra, or the violinist can be set up in not necessarily opposition, but in the Beethoven concerto, it's really back and forth. Yeah. So how do you feel about being a concerto soloist and your persona?
I do enjoy the concertos where there's a lot of ensemble and give and take, and I just like it when it feels like a chamber music experience. You know, when it's, you know, soloist plus accompanied, you know, it's not as much fun nor is it satisfying to be on stage, because when you have the intricate and detailed work of a score where the more you look into it, you know, the more you discover and the more you realize how, like the Brahms concerto, for example, you know, for me, that is just the most monumental concerto out there, because you really look at the entire piece and you think of it as a symphony. I think of it as one, as another one of Brahms' symphonies where he just gave the violin solo an extra line. You know, because it feels from beginning to end, it feels as if it's just one big wave of being a fantastic symphony, and then he just, you know, intermittently, you know, gave the violin an extra little melody here and there. And it really is, as in like the second moment, for example, he doesn't even give the violin the first melody. He gives the first melody, the most important melody of arguably the entire concerto is in the second movement, and he gives it to the oboe first. You know, he doesn't even give it to the violin first. You know, so I really do believe that once you realize that the violin solo part is amazingly unimportant sometimes, and open up your ears and start listening to every single instrument that's in the orchestra with you, and it becomes so much more interesting and so much more of a humbling experience as well when you're up there.
Yeah, we had Brahms' Second Piano Concerto on Sunday, and I mentioned that it is essentially the Fifth Symphony of Brahms, but I guess now there's a Sixth. Okay. Great. And Patrick, what about working with concerto soloists? And Sarah alluded to the fact that typically the rehearsal period will begin with a private meeting of the conductor and the soloist. Now, don't tell us if this is true with whom, but have you ever had a difficult meeting with a soloist?
You're talking to someone who runs an opera company. Joking aside, I mean, opera is, of course, one big concerto for voice. So I'm accustomed to the idea of making chamber music with a soloist, because that's what opera is, and that's what opera at its greatest is. So I find with the concertos that I've conducted with instrumental soloists, I found that if I approach them the same way that I approach singers, and you know, as chamber music, how do we fit this together with our ideas, and the ideas that you don't have to talk about are always the ones that are the best. Generally, they're the ones because they're the ones you just mutually feel. So I can't recall a, you know, soloist meeting that was particularly difficult. Sometimes you approach a piece in a different way, and so you have to find a way to meet, but that's I've found to be rather rare too. So maybe I've just been lucky. But.
So also on the program is an unusual work, at least I think it's unusual because we've never had it in my time in Aspen, but it's very, very popular with violinists. And this is a work by Vitali. Vitali was an Italian composer, roughly contemporaneous with Bach. And he wrote this chaconne, which also was originally, I think, just for organ, maybe, and violin.
Yeah, continuo, maybe.
And then various composers since then, because violinists love the piece so much, have made all kinds of arrangements for it. Is it the one we're doing Charlier, or is it?
Charlier.
Yeah, okay. So tell us about this piece, because I think many people will not know it.
Sarah? Gorgeous piece. Yeah.
It is such a beautiful piece, you guys. Seriously, it is one of my absolute favorite pieces. And as you mentioned, it's just not done very often for some reason or other. And it's one of those pieces that nobody's quite sure when he wrote it, you know. And if you look at, you know, his birth date, and then usually like when you go through like a composer's biography, they tell you when he also passed away. And in Vitali's case, it's a big question mark. You know, because they don't even know. So a lot of question marks with this piece. But what's so beautiful about it is that it's the same sort of eight measures?
Eight bar bass line.
Eight bar bass line. in about a gazillion different variations that you could possibly think of. And it is the most astonishingly beautiful and powerful and dramatic piece with so much depth and nobility in it.
It's a very spiritual work, yeah, somehow. It's a beautiful piece.
It is. Yeah. And I remember I recorded it many, many, many years ago. I think I was like 13 or so. And I remember when I looked at the piece and I went with a friend of mine to look for a pipe organ to see if I wanted to record it with an organ or with an orchestra. And I absolutely love the sound with the organ and how much space it gave everything, you know, and how just absolutely gorgeous it was. But the problems with playing with an organ, number one, to get a recording team in there and to mic it in a way where the organ does not overpower the violin completely. And also, if anyone here has played the organ, you press the note, and it's not like a piano. You know, if with the piano, you press the note and you hear the sound. With an organ, it takes like literally about 9 months for the sound to come on. You will hear it in the next zip code, maybe. And, you know, it literally takes forever. So the ensemble was unbelievably tricky just to get everything together because the response time from the organ and the way that I was playing the violin, it would not work. So we ended up doing it with the London Philharmonic and Maestro Haitink conducting it with orchestra. But both versions, I think, are exquisitely beautiful.
And as a factoid about this piece, Yasha Heifetz chose it to be on his New York debut recital. So it is a favorite. Great. Intermission. I don't think we need to talk about the intermission. Then the second half, and it opens with Wagner's prelude to the first act of Lohengrin. This is one of the all-time favorites in what you might call overture rep. Anything special, different? You've conducted Lohengrin in the opera house many times.
Well, when we were talking about this season's programs and we knew Sarah wanted to play Tzigane and the Chaconne, we wanted to build a program around that. And also that the broader theme of the year was enchantment. I thought, well, you know, the love for Three Oranges, which I know we'll talk about in a second, of Prokofiev, I was very, very attracted to playing that because it's all about it's a very enchanted opera and a plot about an enchanted prince, and I wanted something that would kind of talk to the Prokofiev, and the Prokofiev opera, The Love for Three Oranges, has a character in it based on a character in Lohengrin, based on Ortrud in Lohengrin, and Lohengrin is itself a very enchanted plot. It has a lot of magic. So I thought the two pieces would play really beautifully together.
Huh, fascinating. That's the Fata Morgana character.
It's based on Ortrud.
So, Stephen, I want to come back to you just to talk about the form of the prelude to Act 1 of Lohengrin, because there are lots of arch forms in music, but very few as extreme, I think, as this piece. Yeah. So
I'm going to admit that I haven't heard that piece in decades. And that's why I come to things like this. It's one of the occupational hazards of being in the composition business is you end up kind of mostly looking at what's going on right now. So I, for example, a year ago, I had an occasion where I looked at about 1,000 pieces by young composers and other composers, and I didn't have any time to listen to the standard rep. But I have found that when I get to hear these pieces, because it's not really snobism, because I just don't get to hear them, that I hear them entirely afresh. Like, for example, a few years ago, a piece of mine was done with the Tchaikovsky Fifth. I hadn't heard it for ages. And I thought, wow, this is a great piece. So I am looking forward to that revelation on Friday.
Well, it is a great piece indeed. Patrick, do you want to talk about the formal idea of
Lohengrin?
Yeah.
Lohengrin is not an overture in the way that other Wagner operas, Meistersinger or The Flying Dutchman, have, you know, formal three-part overtures. The prelude to Lohengrin very much sets us into the very ethereal musical world of Lohengrin and this distant night. The meaning Lohengrin, the night, arrives into Act One on the back of a swan. And across a lake, he, you know, the image is him coming from a great distance across an enormous lake with mountains in the background. And so the prelude to Lohengrin is meant to evoke very, very distant light that gradually comes into focus, and symbolizing Lohengrin's arrival. But Wagner, when he was exiled in the late 1840s, when he was exiled to Zurich, he used to spend day after day after day by Lake Zurich, and he was obsessed with the swans, which are there to this day, and was reading the epic literature that he spent his entire life realizing, of which Lohengrin was one, Parsifal, Lohengrin's son, was another, and he was so obsessed with swans and lakes and the legend of Lohengrin, and the result is this extraordinary prelude that is among the most ethereal sort of, you know, it's just music you can see right through. It's an extraordinary thing, the prelude to Lohengrin. So different from the Prokofiev, yeah.
So let's talk about Prokofiev. So this is a suite that Prokofiev made from an opera. The opera is called The Love for Three Oranges. Do you want to talk about the plot of this, or shall we...
Take a while. It's one of those very, very convoluted, absurdist theater plots that Prokofiev was quite attracted to. It was based on a play by Gozzi, who was the playwright who also wrote the play of on which Turandot is based, which is from the same era as The Love for Three Oranges. And the Love for Three Oranges was a commission from Chicago. It was an American commission. It was to be, they commissioned a Russian composer, but they didn't think that American audiences would stand for an opera in Russian. Prokofiev didn't feel good enough about his English to write an opera in English, so they decided to write it in French. So it's an American commission of a French opera by a Russian composer.
To an Italian. Yeah. Play.
By an Italian play, yeah. Yes.
Well, and the picturesque fact is, thus the premiere was in the Auditorium Theater in Chicago, the very grand Louis Sullivan Theater. So I think that's fun. Okay, we're not going to talk about the plot. It has a giant rat in it. But the music was so attractive that Prokofiev did make an orchestral suite. The march is especially famous. If I could whistle, I would whistle it, and you would go, oh, yeah, that thing. But to what degree, Patrick, do you think the audience should know about the plot to get what the six segments are?
Oh, I don't. I actually think in the case of this orchestral suite, it isn't necessary at all. But the plot is an absurdist plot. It's about a prince of a mythical kingdom who is melancholy, and the aim of his courtiers is to make him laugh. And they bring in all of these characters to try to make him laugh or smile, which he finally does, but to the horror of the witch, Fata Morgana, who puts a curse on him that he will fall in love with three oranges. And which also eventually happens late in the plot. So we're talking about very, very absurdist theater here and very fantastical, scherzo-filled music. So it's thrilling orchestral textures that are mostly comic. It's actually quite a comic suite. There's a short bit of the prince and his princess, who's one of the princesses that comes out of one of the oranges. That's very, very beautiful, very reminiscent of the Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet love music. But largely this is quite lighthearted and brilliant orchestral music.
Have you ever conducted the opera?
No, I haven't actually.
Have you ever seen the opera?
I've seen the opera a lot.
I've not seen it.
Yeah, I saw it at Covent Garden a long time ago.
I thought you never saw classical music.
That wasn't what I said. But I did see it. And am I correct in remembering that it starts with an argument in the audience?
Yes.
That you have the chorus scattered around the audience, and the music starts, and then there are people shouting, and you don't know. And I'd never seen it before.
Yes, and they go from the auditorium onto the stage. Yeah, it's very rarely done piece because it's so enormous. It's, you know, it's larger than Aida to perform. So,
also, if I'm not mistaken, it was written right at the end of the First World War, and so long before Prokofiev went back to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And what he was presenting when he came to the U.S. was the classical symphony, the First Symphony. So that's what they heard and thought, ooh, we should get this guy to write an opera. But it's different in style.
It's more related to the classical symphony than it is certainly something like the Fifth Symphony, I would say. But as in terms of Prokofiev's operas, it's his absolute departure. I mean, this is a man who wrote, you know, War and Peace and The Gambler and operas based on Dostoevsky and Pushkin. So The Love for Three Oranges is a real departure for Prokofiev, and it's his operetta, let's say. Yeah. Very lighthearted.
Great. Well, I think we might take a break to see if you have questions for any or all of our group today. And if you do, wait, because we'll run a microphone to you since we are taping this for broadcast and for podcast. Yes. Okay, now suddenly we have a lot of them.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Thank you. You talked at the beginning about how composers stay away sometimes from first rehearsals, and I was wondering if composers are ever asked or tempted to conduct their own works in any of these rehearsals.
Not in the rehearsals. There are plenty of composer conductors. There's a very fine one in this room, Donald Crockett, who conducts the contemporary ensemble here. But I have always shied away from it because I know I'm not good at it. And I don't want people talking about that aspect of my life behind my back.
Yeah, I would say for myself, as a conductor, I'm a really okay composer. By which I mean I'm not at all a conductor. I wouldn't dream of doing it.
Yeah, I like to leave it to the professionals.
Yeah.
What I have found with I've worked with many, many composers on a number of projects. I have found that even the ones who are conductors and very good conductors, they have sometimes, not always, this is a generalization, but they have sometimes found it difficult to lavish the kind of attention that a conductor must in a rehearsal on music that they wrote. Because it's not a disconnect, it's a sort of modesty. You know, that because a conductor has to advocate for the finest performance of every single bar. And I think composers sometimes are so happy to hear it at all it's a different art. You know, conducting is different from creating it. We're the recreators. And it's hard to recreate something you've created, I think.
Do you think it's kind of like when surgeons don't operate on family
members?
I do. Yeah, I think it's kind of the same
thing.
Yeah,
I do.
Right?
Yeah. I do.
I think that's a really good comparison. And I would also say it's a little to the side of the question, but I'm interested in how Stephen feels about this. One might think that the composer knows the maximum amount about the composer's piece and everyone else knows less than the composer. And that would suggest the composer would be a great conductor of the piece. But I have learned so much about my own music from really wonderful performers that I don't see it as that pyramid thing.
Well, yeah, I would second that too. I think when the piece is done and you're handed over, I think that what I'm looking for is the discovery that someone else is going to make within it and tell me things about it. When I'm writing, I often, if I feel like I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing, that's when I know it's going well. So I'm looking forward to that.
Sarah, have you ever worked with a composer and ended up offering advice? Like, what if we did this?
Yeah, I have worked with a few composers. Richard Daniel Poor, one of them, Donald Sir, another of them, and then Christopher Theofanides. He's a wonderful, wonderful man, and he wrote a concerto for me as well several years ago. And I've seen both sides where one composer has gone through all the drafts himself, and he hands me the final draft and tells me, this is it. Go learn it. I'll see you at the concert. And that's it, you know? And it's pretty clear that he's already gone through many drafts, and in his mind, that's it. That's the final version, and this is what he's happy with. And your job then as a violinist is to go and learn it and give the best performance of the piece as you possibly can. Christopher, whom I adore, was very, very honest with me from the beginning and told me that he had never written for the violin before. But I had listened to Rainbow Body, and I knew him personally from other concerts, and we had just started hanging out, and I loved him as a person and as a musician. And we truly worked on the piece together, and it took almost 2 years because he would send me drafts. And this was, by the way, at a time where I wasn't traveling with a BlackBerry or a laptop or an iPad, none of that stuff, right? So he was faxing me pages to hotel rooms, right? He was faxing me pages, and sometimes, you know, you'd be overseas, I'd be in Europe, and, you know, some of it would come up sort of smudged, and I'd have to call him and say, so page 17 is a little smudged, so I need you to resend that. And I would, you know, put him on speakerphone, and I'd play passages for him, and we'd literally go over measure by measure. And what I loved about that was that we literally lived through it together, because he had his daughter while he was writing the second movement. And he said that as soon as he had her, and he brought her back from the hospital, and he sort of sat her down on his lap while he was playing the piano. And he said she just sort of, like, with her hand, sort of played a few notes. So the first three notes of the second movement of the concerto are three notes that his daughter played. So like, when you get to know these stories and talk to the composer himself and get these sort of personal, you know, anecdotes, it makes you closer to the piece, and you treat it like one of your own, and you know, and then when you go through the whole rehearsal process, and he's there every step of the way and continues to make changes to a point where at the dress rehearsal, I said to him, I love you, Christopher, but that's it. No more changes. Concerts tonight. That's it. No more changes. But I mean, I love that process, and I find it fascinating, to see, you know, how a piece evolves, within the composer's mind, and, you know, how the whole experience sort of changes you from beginning to end.
I think we had one up here.
I wondered Sarah, whether you had ever come across a conductor that asked you to play to the limit of your feelings about the music, where you actually thought differently than the conductor, so that you wanted to compromise a little less, but you were forced to compromise more than you actually wanted to.
I think every week is some sort of compromise, but in a really good way, where you're learning something from every person that you're working with, and you give and take, and there's always something that you want to open your ears and your eyes up to, and you really want to go away from every rehearsal feeling that you learned something, that you can do something better. I'm very lucky, I think, in the fact that there have only been maybe two instances, I think, in my entire career where the chemistry just hasn't meshed. You know, and after the first rehearsal, I genuinely think in about the 30 or so years that I've been playing the violin, there have only been two instances, you know, where I finished the first rehearsal and I went to my hotel room and I called my manager and said, that's it, I'm leaving. I'm not working with this person, I am leaving. And then, of course, the manager's job is to calm you down, you know, and sort of talk you through it and say, what can I do to get you through the next 2 days, you know. So you do try to find compromises along the way. And the thing is that, you know, everybody that you see on stage, everybody that you see who creates music, plays music, and are performers, you know, we all have very strong personalities at the end of the day. And we have conviction and a certain idea of how we want things to go, but most of us do have an open mind and, you know, willing to go through rehearsals and treat it as a learning process to get to know the partner that you have that week.
I wonder, Patrick, if you'd comment on rehearsal process, because a great touring soloist, it is a lot of short bursts. It's 3 or 4 days in rehearsal and you know, maybe a very intense communication, but then it's over. And if you're preparing an opera, your worldwide, world-famous soloists are probably with you for weeks. And so how does that go?
Well, opera is a different case because it's so much larger and so many more people are performing from memory. You know, in an orchestral concert, the soloist is performing from memory, but no one else is. But in a performance of a large opera, more than half of your people are performing from memory, which is, changes the rehearsal dynamic considerably. But I love what I can learn from my colleagues, and you know, Sarah has so much more experience with these two violin pieces than I do. So there's a lot for me to learn about it. I bring, you know, my own ideas about it, but you have to be ready to learn what it is with each other, because it's one piece to me alone, it's one piece to Sarah alone, but it's a third piece with us together. And that's why we perform live at all. And so changing your mind about a piece is one of the few ways you can be sure you have a mind, you know. So
it's, I have a mind, therefore I change it. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Don't be shy. Yes.
I have a question that may be a little off topic, but I'd like to ask Mr. Harkey. He mentioned that he'd listened to 1,000 contemporary composers, and I wonder if one of them is the young woman who has recently captivated me. I first found why I paid attention was her name is the same as my daughter, and after a concert, I went home and Googled her and found that she was born in the same town in eastern North Carolina that I was. And then I saw that at the age of 30 in 2013, she had won the Pulitzer Prize for music at the earliest age ever. And then I saw an article titled, Is Caroline Shaw the Future of Music?
Well, I certainly know that piece that won the Pulitzer, and it's a quite remarkable work, and a remarkable performance especially. She wasn't in that group of composers that I was looking at. It was a job search, and she wasn't looking for one at that moment. She's doing okay.
Who takes the lead when a violinist and a conductor are sort of opposed to the actual performance? Who leads whom?
Whoever wears the higher heels.
Well, we know who that is. Yes. Yeah. It really depends on where you are in the score. There are places where we will say in rehearsal, you know, I conductor need to lead this and you follow me. And there are places where I will say, Sarah, you need to lead this and let me follow you. That's part of conducting a concerto, and so that give and take, but that's something that we decide as we go through the rehearsal process. You may want to answer that differently.
Exactly. I think the key points where you need to lock eyes and decide who's going to lead this phrase, who's going to lead that phrase, I think are the points that we go through on our own, yeah, before the concert. Those are what the rehearsals are for, where we decide on the key points. Okay, the conductor leads this point, the soloist leads this point. But I think more important than any of all of that, because frankly, at the concert, sometimes you forget, right? So it's really all about just watching constantly, just locking eyes and watching and making sure that I'm watching his eyes and also watching his baton. And I think for the conductor, it's mainly watching the bow, right? To see when the bow changes are, so that your tempo changes are together. So it really is you know, about planning in advance, but then spur of the moment at the time of the concert, just watching and, you know, doing things spontaneously.
You rehearse so that you can be free of all of that in performance. So that's what the rehearsal is for, is to unlock the performance. So that's, we both lead, but it bounces back and forth.
Now, I've told this story before, and I've been cautioned never to reveal the people involved. But we were talking about Beethoven Violin Concerto, and so, of course, it opens with the timpani strokes. So the conductor has set the tempo. But I heard a performance in which the soloist and conductor, who were very good friends, but they could not agree on the underlying tempo of that first movement. And as a result, when the violinist came in, the violinist came in at the violinist's tempo, which was not the tempo that was prevailing. And in that piece, it's possible that the violinist just took over. And then at the next tutti, when the violinist stopped, all of a sudden the tempo went right back to the original one. And it was like a seesaw. It went back and forth the entire time. But
I think there are two trains of thought there, because, of course, the ideal situation is that you want to be on the same page when you get to the concert. But there are times when you go on stage, and if the tempo is not exactly what you want it to be, I think there are two schools of thought. When you come in as a soloist, you know, there's a school of thought, okay, you start, and since you're playing alone, you go at the tempo you want. And then there's the other school of start that makes everybody look bad on stage. That makes it seem as if either you're under-rehearsed or that you're not getting along with the orchestra or the conductor. So the second school of thought, which I think is the more gracious approach, is to start at the tempo that the conductor and the orchestra left you off with. Even if you don't agree with it, to start with that tempo and then gradually take it to the tempo that you want. So that it is more of a graduation than just an abrupt, I don't like your tempo, this is my tempo, and then the abrupt slowdown as well when the 2D comes back. You know, I just think it's a much more gracious way to sort of ease into what hopefully, you know, you can influence.
Say, speaking of gracious, Sarah is playing in Harris Hall next week with Vivaldi Four Seasons in a beautiful, beautiful program. And we had been saying it was sold out, and so I wasn't even going to mention it today because why raise your hopes for something? But although there is a fairly large ensemble playing with Sarah in the program, so we had thought there would be no room on stage, but Sarah has graciously figured out a way to open up some stage seats. So I don't want to start a gold rush stampede, but if you go out of here straight to the box office, you might possibly get a ticket. It's going to be one of the most highly anticipated recitals, I think, of our whole summer. So, yeah, thank you for that. I think we will wrap up. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you to our listening audience.